It's that time of year again.
Christmas comes but once a year.
It just seems longer.
Time for merrymaking and bellyaching.
Because she was trying to be kind to her parishioners, she agreed to have three different sets of Christmas lunch.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Isn't it?
For sharing and caring with your nearest and dearest.
That's carrying patriotism a bit far, that, isn't it?
There's a new traitor of Scarf, kid. I got a bit of respect for Her Majesty, I have.
And then, after all that's done, it's time to sit down in front of some good old-fashioned Christmas entertainment.
I love Christmas, Telly. All them stars giving up their Christmases just to entertain us.
They don't give up their Christmases. All them programmes is recorded in October.
We'll be hearing more from the dysfunctional duo of Albert and Harold Steptoe later, but first, hello and a hearty seasonal welcome to my comedy Christmas classics. I'm David Jason, and over the next hour, I'll be taking you through the wonderland that is festive comedy, with the help of some of our greatest writers, performers, and producers.
Sleigh bells ring. Are you listening?
The BBC's attitude towards its entertainment programmes is largely governed by the fact that broadcasting is a part of the domestic life of a nation.
Oh, yes. Thank you, voice of reason. I almost forgot that for the next hour, we'll also be seeing the development of broadcast Christmas comedy through the immortal words of the BBC Green Book, which was the variety programme's policy guide for writers and performers released in the late 1940s. Yes, I know. I got one for Christmas as well.
You're into this Christmas bubble, which is about, 36 hours each side of the event. And it's a different planet, isn't it?
The celebrated writer Roy Clark, who's penned the immensely successful sitcoms Last of the Summer Wine, Keeping Up Appearances, and, of course, Open All Hours.
He's got to be family-friendly. You're aware of this bleary-eyed guy on a sofa somewhere who's full and had maybe a little bit to drink and just wants to be amused.
Will you be staying late, Anthony?
Yeah. Well, after they've had the dinner, I always play charades, and parlour games and that.
Parlour games!
Is the telly broke?
You're intruding in a very intimate family situation, really, with the Christmas special.
Oh, there's no place like home for the holidays.
One of the two Ronnies, Ronnie Corbett.
There's one time of year where hopefully the children, the grandchildren, the grandparents and the uncles and aunts maybe are looking at the same programme, and gathering around and enjoying themselves as a family. That's part of the appeal and I think part of the rule-making that goes on when you make the programme, remembering that all ages are watching.
People are in the little groups that matter to them. And it's a very special area, there's no question about it. So you're conscious of that too. You've got to try to fit whatever you're doing within that mood as well.
I'll be home for Christmas. You can plan on me.
I just speak as a viewer, really. I think you want it warm, you want it family, you want it funny.
John Plowman, distinguished BBC producer whose career spans over 30 years and includes such shows as A Bit of Fry and Laurie, French and Saunders, Absolutely Fabulous, The Vicar of Dibley, The League of Gentlemen, The Office, Little Britain and The Thick of It. In fact, there's a shorter list of what he hasn't done somewhere. If I could just find it.
You also want to remember that even though it's going out at 9:30, you've still got families of essentially drunken people lolling in front of the television. So you've got to remember that you should try to embarrass as few of them, or as many of them as possible. And, as it were, keep the right side of filth.
This year, my present to you, I'm getting sick of Christmas, I'm already sick of you.
I've always looked upon Christmas as a time of disaster.
Ray Galton, who along with writing partner Alan Simpson, successfully created light from the characters with a dark side through Hancock's Half Hour and Steptoe and Son.
Every show that we did about Christmas, or around about that time, was terrible things about Christmas, where families fall out and refuse to speak to each other for another 25 years or something.
You've been putting out the same rubbish since I was five. The whole thing is pathetic.
If I left it to you, we'd never get anything put up. We wouldn't have any decorations.
Yeah, that's what. But what is the point of decorating this rat hole? It's like trying to grow daffodils on that dung heap out there. I cannot disguise the sordidness of this sewer with a few coloured strips of paper.
Well, it's only once a year.
Yeah, that's another thing. Rest of the year, you never touch the place. It takes a bleeding excavation to find the floorboards.
For me, one of my most anticipated shows as an early fan of comedy was The Goons. Messrs. Milligan, Seacombe, Sellers and Benteen, and their recipe of light-hearted lunacy has been described by radio historians as the shining example of originality. And I can agree with that.
For no reason at all, folks. What's the date today? 24th of December, Christmas Eve. So they both fall on the same day. Must be slippery.
Yes, well, I don't think we can wait any longer for any more laughs on that one. Now, back to work or I'll belt your nothing.
But, Mr. Scrooge, it's Christmas Eve, the time of goodwill and custard.
So it is. Merry Christmas, Scratchy.
Merry Christmas!
Now get back to your desk or I'll belt your nothing.
Hey, Mr. Scrooge, can I go home 2 seconds early tonight?
Do it, seconds? You must be mad.
Have a say to the next bloke.
I'm the next bloke, folks.
I was a massive fan of radio when I was a young lad. But the reason why I just loved The Goon Show was because, as the name seemed to suggest, they were completely anarchic, they were original, they were off the planet. And to us young lads, that was just what we needed. It was completely bizarre, but having said that, it was extremely funny.
I'm walking backwards for Christmas across the Irish Sea. I'm walking backwards for Christmas. It's the only thing for me. I've tried walking sideways and walking to the front, but people just look at me and...
Entertainment and Christmas go hand in hand, so it was an easy equation made by radio early on. Music hall concerts were relayed as part of its festive programming, and when shows started to be made in-house, they could hardly miss the opportunity to mark the most important holiday in the calendar. Among the long-running post-war shows that didn't miss the trick of doing something special for an expectant Christmas following were Raise a Laugh with Peter Sellers and Patricia Hayes, Educating Archie with Hattie Jakes, and, of course, Hancock's Half Hour.
Oh, this is ridiculous. Why should I have to dress up every year just because Bill still believes in Santa Claus?
Oh, you can't disappoint him. You know how he looks forward to Christmas and waking up in the morning and finding that Father Christmas has paid him a visit. His little cheeks flushed with excitement, his eyes all aglow, and the little squeals of delight as he unwraps his presents and sees what he's got.
Good grief, woman, the man is 34. It's not...
If there was ever a character to echo Scrooge's bar humbug sentiments, it was Tony Hancock, arguably one of comedy's greatest characters. His approach was unique, with the comedy built almost entirely around him, rather than around the situations, surreal or domestic, that are most often the focus.
You know as well as I do it's not right for a man of his years to write letters to Father Christmas. It's about time he faced up to the facts of life, ugly as they may be. I knew when I was three. My old man sorted that. Catch him buying presents and dressing up. He said he wasn't going to lash out all that money and let somebody else take the credit for it.
As Tony Hancock's star passed both the peaks of his radio and television work, Round the Horn was just getting started under the watchful eye of another radio comedy great, Kenneth Horne.
This is for you, Fiona. I hope you like it.
Charles, what is this? Such an unusual shape. But what a pretty ribbon.
I had them put it on in the shop. Do you want it now, or will you wait until after the Queen's speech?
No, Charles. No, Charles. Darling, please pass me the scissor. How lovely. Oh, you shouldn't have.
I wanted you to have it, Fiona. It belonged to my grandmother.
Thank you, Charles. Thank you. But what is it?
My grandfather.
Kenneth provided us with two of our most enduring radio comedy shows, Beyond Our Ken and Round the Horn, just heard there. For both, Horn was ringmaster to a collection of bawdy, eccentric and downright silly characters played by a core group. Kenneth Williams, Hugh Paddock, Bill Pertwee and Betty Marsden. Coming as it did in the swinging 60s, Round the Horn was more risque than Beyond Our Ken and had an almost scandalous knack of slipping in innuendo. Roy Clark.
It was its amazing cheek. I mean, it was very funny. It was very funny. But it was also quite far out for its time, except it was in a language, I think, that people never realised that. And I think its anchorman sounded so respectably middle class that nobody ever realised this was quite a naughty programme going on.
Back at the kitchen range is my third daughter, Cinderella, played by swarthy, guttural ex-bomber pilot Betty Marsden. She sits among the cinders, a rosy glow on her cheeks.
Programs must, at all costs, be kept free of crudities, coarseness, and innuendo. Humor must be clean and untainted directly or by association with vulgarity and suggestion.
Well, Round the Horn definitely tossed away the original 1940s BBC rulebook at this point. Writers Barry Took and Marty Feldman had the opportunity to put double meanings in mouths in which butter wouldn't melt. And in the mouth of Kenneth Williams, a gift horse in matters of innuendo.
Allow me to greet you in the traditional manner.
On the hand, Ken. You're supposed to kiss me on the hand.
I'm only doing what it says in the script, Ducky. I assure you there's no pleasure in it for me. Oh, no.
Bill Pertwee was all too aware of the direction that Round the Horn was taking.
I think it became coarser in the nicest possible way, which Beyond Our Ken wasn't. I mean, Kenneth Horne, as a broadcaster, he was great. He really was.
By the time Round the Horn reached its abrupt end with Ken Horne's death in 1969, many writing teams and producers were forging careers in television. Consequently, when it came to entertaining the nation at Christmas, TV was inevitably assuming a dominant role. The process started in 1951... with television's Christmas Party. The BBC followed this venture up with Christmas Night with the Stars. Alan Simpson, the other half of the writing team on Hancock's Half Hour and Steptoe and Son, remembers that this new seasonal showcase was seen as a crucial gig by the performers of the day.
58 Christmas Night with the Stars. Every star in the business would be fighting to get on it. Great prestige show.
Yes, there's no doubt about it. He is getting old.
He doesn't improve himself, Vicar. I'm thinking of selling him and buying a new one.
Oh, so that's the way things are shaping, is it? To give him another best years of my life, I'm to be flogged for a parrot. You didn't expect any more from me tonight. Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall and that was my luck. Oh, what, they'll ask me to do a turn in a minute.
How would you like to hear you to say a little piece, Vicar?
Oh, Miss Snitterby, I'd love to.
Here we go, cabaret time.
Come along, beauty. Recite something for the vicar.
Recite something for the vicar. It'll be a pleasure. This will be my swan song. I shall go out in a blaze of glory, eh? There was a young lady named Nellie who had a tattoo.
Beauty!
Tony Hancock there in his ever-so-memorable budgerigar sketch. TV's Christmas comedy selection gradually evolved from showcases into sitcoms which were proving to be a neat way of reflecting the changing face of society in post-war Britain. The new shows allowed a new generation to find its voice, culturally and politically.
Well, certainly Johnny Spaeth and Alf Garnett did broaden our attitudes to what people would say and how right-wing and fascist or, you know, I mean, you wouldn't have thought people would say in light entertainment before.
Oh, God, love, sit down! It's a mark of respect, isn't it? It's your national anthem! You're quite airy, Nelly. Well, you've got a stain.
Oh, don't be daft, Dad.
It ain't daft, you're ignorant little. It's a mark of respect to her, isn't it?
And him.
Not in front of the television set in your own home, though. I mean, come on, that's carrying patriotism a bit far, that is, isn't it?
Yes, and you traitor of scarce git. I got a bit of respect for Her Majesty, I have. She has to have her Christmas dinner late because of doing that speech. Oh. She has to go up to the BBC.
Well, they keep it warm for her, though.
Look, she has to... she has to go up to the BBC.
No, they put it in the oven for her.
Look, she has to go up to the studio.
Look, he'd see to that.
Look, she has to go up
to... He'd make sure it was prepped up for her.
Shut up, you silly moo!
One group of sitcom characters who also had their fair share of standing for the national anthem were the ragtag collection of Warmington-on-Sea's Home Guard, better known as Dad's Army.
Who do you think you are kidding, Mr. Hitler, if you think we're on the run?
Running for 9 years and a total of 80 episodes, Dad's Army's first of three Christmas specials was broadcast in 1971.
Well, I think Dad's Army had an appeal to the whole family because we used to get letters from people who were maybe, they used to say, oh, I'm 30 years old and I, you know. And then the next week you'd get a letter from a kid of, say, six, saying, oh, I love it. And yes, they were a good team. Very eccentric, of course.
Bill Pertwee played the brusque and pompous ARP warden William Hodges, always gunning for Arthur Lowe's equally pompous but less forward Captain Mannering.
Now, as chairman, may I just bring the meeting to order and welcome...
Hold on a minute. Why ever is it, whenever we have a meeting about anything, you're always the chairman? Who elected you? That's what I want to know.
It was perfectly above board and legal. Mm-hmm. I was elected by the steering committee.
Oh. And who elected the steering committee?
I did.
Arthur was quite an eccentric fellow, and he took some time to... it didn't take time to learn his lines. The fact is that he didn't learn them very fast. David Cross said to him one day, Arthur, I wonder if you could sort of, you know, you're taking up some of our rehearsal time learning your lines. Yes, well, fine. It isn't actually fine. I tell you what I'll do. I'll give you a script you can use here in the rehearsal room. I can say here. I'll give you another one to take home. You say, take home? I wouldn't have that rubbish in my house.
That rubbish joins a long list of sitcoms that made the 1970s the golden age for the genre. The Likely Lads had grown up, and we were famously finding out whatever happened to them. While its creators, Clement and Lafrenet, were serving us porridge. David Croft had started up another long-running concern with Are You Being Served? Both writers and performers were at the top of their game.
Blimey, you know, they get bigger every year.
Don't be so personal.
I was referring to the crackers. I wonder what I've got in mind.
You mustn't pull it till after the pud.
I can't get over not having to queue up.
Yet it's nice to be waited on once a year.
May I wish you a rather premature happy Christmas and offer this wine as my contribution to the gala occasion.
Oh, that's very kind of you, Stephen. I must say. Has anyone got a corkscrew?
That won't be necessary. You just unscrew it.
Don't forget your hat.
Oh, very well, if I must.
White wine's my favourite. Mm. Thin blank coupe. Whereabouts is coupe?
That's co-op.
Christmas specials were now on the map. But it wasn't just the sitcom that was getting a slice of the turkey. Alan Simpson.
There seemed to be a much greater emphasis on Christmas shows in the 70s than there are now. Everybody had their own Christmas show. People used to sit in and watch them, and that's the whole point. Morecambe and Wise Christmas show probably got its highest ever, you know, 25, 27 million people would tune in.
What guest stars have we got on the show, Eric? I didn't
actually... None!
None?
None!
You mean nobody, no guest stars at all?
Nobody will work with us anymore, and they've all tumbled.
Well, must be somebody needs the money.
Well, there's only one.
Who's
there's one fellow who'll work with us.
Who?
What's his name? Elephant John.
No, you mean Elton John?
Him. It was on the last Christmas show.
Oh, we don't. We don't.
Sang the musical song, all sentimental, and got laughs.
No. We don't want him.
No, no.
On top of that, he's too expensive, isn't he?
Yeah.
How much does he want?
35 quid and two Luton players.
Why, that's almost £50.
John Plowman.
People you want to see at Christmas, you want to sort of welcome into your home. I suppose, you know, Morecambe and Wise are the kings of it, and I bet somewhere in the Christmas schedules this year there will be some sort of a compilation of their Christmas shows, because they got it right.
So they're all the violins?
No, no, there's nothing wrong with the violins.
That's only your opinion.
What were you playing just then?
The Greek piano concerto.
You're playing all the wrong notes.
I'm playing all the right notes, but not necessarily in the right order.
They were the first people who got very big stars to do things that seemed odd. You know, now you can't move for the sort of comic relief / children in need thing of a bunch of newsreaders doing a song.
Let's take the road before us and sing a chorus or two. Come on, it's lovely weather for us, we're right together with you.
The comedy teams that shone in the 1970s weren't an old boys' club. In fact, the makeup of the entertainment industry reflected all walks of life. Sitcom was particularly democratic in cast, crew, and content.
A group of us sprang at the same time, like the crocus comes up. At the same time, we all came up out of the soil. And I suppose, in a way, we were competing with each other, although we didn't realize it.
Carla Lane, the creator of many exquisite domestic comedies. Both The Live of Birds and Butterflies meant that there wasn't much of the 1970s where her work wasn't being aired.
There's no doubt about it, there was a moment in time for comedy.
Ronnie Corbett.
The strength of that period, of course, was writer-based, I suppose, and casting clever actors who could act with comedy without necessarily being comedians, in inverted commas.
Conceived in 1973 as a one-off sitcom for the BBC's Comedy Playhouse series, Last of the Summer Wine, a tale of old men behaving badly in the West Yorkshire countryside, only ended in 2010 after 37 years. It earned its place in history as the world's longest-running sitcom, and in the nation's hearts, because of its simple life-affirming approach that could be likened to three old-timers going on a long and eventful Boxing Day walk. Creator Roy Clark explains.
You could say, I suppose, that Summer Wine was tending towards that sort of Christmas feeling about it. It was a sort of Neverland, fairyland. It wasn't too far off Christmas anyway, so I think generally Summer Wine fitted well into a Christmas slot.
Christmas comes but once a year. It just seems longer.
Because I'm used to spending it in the army, you know. Oh, Christmas in Clark, there's nothing to beat it.
The thing about Christmas...
The army does them better.
It seems such a long time coming. Before the leaves have fallen these days, they've started advertising British sherry.
There's no one quite captures the spirit of Christmas like the military.
And, of course, it no sooner gets here than it seems to go on forever.
Now, it was at least a fortnight last year. It worries me. The Russians don't have it, you know.
Well, there you are, you see. If you look close enough, there's some good in everybody.
Now, there's no Christmas for them. Now, God is the sort of self-employed person they won't tolerate. But what is going to happen when they wake up to the fact that every year at Christmas, England is more or less closed for a fortnight?
You think they might?
Well, of course they might.
But not, they'd never get in.
And what's to stop them?
On a bank holiday, there'd be a strike at every airport.
Generally speaking, political issues should not be made the running theme of any light entertainment program or item, and references should be no more than incidental.
Peter Salas's Norman Clegg there, staying just inside the rule book on passing comment about the winter of discontent. Last of the Summer Wine's first Christmas special came in 1978. And blazed the trail for extended Christmas specials. The popularity of these winter wonders wasn't lost on the broadcasters, even if it meant asking more of the writers.
It's a huge change from the 30, and it's a different ball game, keeping interest 50 minutes rather than 30. It's much more onerous, really. But it gives you time to spread your wings, so it's very attractive.
Before Last of the Summer Wine began diversifying into mulled wine and pouring out seasonal spin-offs, there were bittersweet festive concoctions to be had at number 24 Oil Drum Lane, Shepherd's Bush. Steptoe & Son started in 1962, but it wasn't until 1973 that its first Christmas-themed special episode. And then another followed a year later to mark the end of the series altogether.
Remember one we did where it was the first time for years he was going to have a Christmas party at home, the young man. And the old man, didn't, he wanted to spend it just the two of them together. And in the end, the old man contracted the chicken pox, which he gave to Harold.
You give it me now! You... deliver to give me chicken pox. He's done it on purpose.
I didn't know, Harold.
I'll kill you! You get better! I will kill you! They've arrived!
They can't come in. We both go out into the stables.
I'm not spending Christmas in a stable.
Jesus did.
So his dad didn't have chicken pox, did he?
And, of course, when the guests arrived, both of them were covered in spots.
Come on, Harold! Open up!
But we got a slight problem.
Hello. He started playing games already.
Oh, think it's going to be good.
Come on, Harold. Open up. I've got something for you.
Oh, so there's been a slight technical hitch. How many of you have had chicken pox?
Chicken what?
We got chicken pox.
We thought you had turkey.
Once again. They had Christmas on their own, and it was a miserable existence.
It'll be lonely this Christmas without you still.
Carla Lane.
That, to me, was a very, very moving comedy, but very funny. It had all the ingredients that comedy should have. You've got to have great happiness and great sorrow, and all the bits in between.
Carla was equally keen-eyed when it came to writing about characters in Traps. She did it with Wendy Craig's unsatisfied housewife Rhea in Butterflies, and she did it again in the mid to late 80s with the Liverpudlian romp Bread.
Ooh, gotta get up, gotta get out,
gotta, ooh,
grab the world by the throat and shout.
The Boswell family in Bread had little choice given the economic climate but to live out of each other's pockets. The inevitable stresses and strains which followed were handled with great spirit and, of course, great humour.
It's no good writing just an ordinary day, which is what the series was like, ordinary days. Bread in particular was lovely to write for Christmas. They're a very buoyant family. They had problems with some members of the family. Mother was harassed to death. Father was useless.
I'll have to go to your mum. We're having another jumble sale at the church. I was all day yesterday getting the stalls ready.
That's what you get for marrying a vicar.
I know. Not only do I get him, his housework and his church, I get his flock as well.
What are you doing, digging the road up?
That's not that noise, does it?
We'll have to get that nice and full. Lags, really.
I don't like the sprouts. I'm separating them.
Why did you put them on your plate in the first place?
Because he's frightened of missing something, that's why.
Oh, I'm fed up with you lot.
There were so many things going on, and at Christmas time I suppose people think that everybody should cheer themselves, cure themselves of all their ill habits. But the Bread family never did. Although it was a loving family, of course, because I think that's what people liked about it.
It's Christmas time all over the world.
One of the most notable things about the 1988 Christmas episode of Bread was that it didn't talk about Christmas at all. And instead, we see the family try and enjoy a holiday in Rome. This off-piste, off-seasonal approach was adopted for the Christmas special of Only Fools and Horses.
Well, the coach leaves in an hour.
It's been a bad old day, hasn't it?
No. It's been all right, bruv. It's been all right. I've really enjoyed myself. I'm feeling a bit cream crackered now, though. I think I might have a touch of that yuppie flu, you know.
Yeah? It'd be something to do with a lobster vindaloo and 14 pina coladas, could it?
Well, might have slowed me down a bit, yeah.
God rest you, merry gentlemen, let nothing you despise.
My personal experience of playing Derek Trotter in Only Fools and Horses was that it was very family orientated. I loved playing the character because he was such a man of the people. He had such aspirations to be someone and go somewhere, but by his own efforts. Unfortunately, bless him, his efforts weren't based very well in anything reliable or anything realistic. But his heart and soul were in the right place.
We are sat in the middle of Peckham at 10:30, dressed up as Batman and Robin. And it was you who chose these costumes. I wanted to go as the Blues Brothers.
We would have still broken down and be in this embarrassing situation, wouldn't we?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'd have been wearing suits and ties. Yeah, right, couple of zooms we'd have looked.
We'd have never have won first prize as the Blues Brothers.
No, but at least we could have walked home.
Oh, look, just shut up and try to think of a way out of this.
You're right, all right, let's just think about it. We phoned the RAC.
Yes! And we asked to get put through to the broken down whilst dressed as a couple of prats department.
Creator John Sullivan is sadly no longer with us. He passed away earlier this year. Writing up until the last, with so many memorable credits, including Citizen Smith, Just Good Friends, Sketches for the Two Ronnies, and of course Only Fools and Horses.
If you've had that broom for 20 years, have you actually swept any roads with it?
Well, of course. But I look after it well. We have an old saying that's been handed down by generations of road sweepers. Look after your broom.
Did your broom will look after you?
No, Dave. It's just look after your broom.
Oh, that old saying.
Yeah. And that's what I've done. I've maintained it for 20 years. This old broom has had 17 new heads, and 14 new handles in its time.
How the hell can it be the same broom, then?
Well, here's a picture of it. What more proof do you need?
Speaking of people who are a right pair, from Laurel and Hardy or Flanagan and Allen to Walliams and Lucas, the double act has been a staple throughout comedy history.
Let's make this Christmas the happiest Christmas, the happiest Christmas of them all.
In the 1970s, we were blessed with two fine exponents of the form in the shape of Morecambe and Wise, and the partnership, of course, of the two Ronnies. If Eric and Ernie were at the peak of their powers in the 1970s and ruled Christmas comedy then, it was the two Ronnies, Barker and Corbett, who were the new sketch kings of festive fun for much of the 1980s.
The essential difference with Eric and Ernie was that their show was written for Eric and Ernie and played by Eric and Ernie, never pretending to be anybody else, you know. Our show was us being different people throughout, really, so we played little character roles. So in a way, I always thought we were easier to write for, in a way, because we could do almost anything that anybody thought was funny and apt. We could play the roles. There would be a role for Ron, a role for me, even if it wasn't a customary one. Whereas Eric and Ernie, of course, had to be very, very accurately written for, because they were always Eric and Ernie.
Talking of which, my sister-in-law has just had quads. It's pretty rare, isn't it, eh?
Rare,
it
certainly is rare.
Doctors say it only happens once in 1,600,000 times.
Blimey. It's the one that she ever found time to do the housework.
As the two Ronnies' final series ran, the burgeoning alternative comedy movement of the early 80s began to throw up a number of new double acts that would shape comedy in one way or another for decades to come. French and Saunders, Rick Mayall and Adrian Edmondson, and the upper crust wing of the comedy revolution, Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie. John Plowman.
Stephen Fry and Hugh Laurie did a rather splendid Christmas show where I seem to remember we recreated It's a Wonderful Life, a movie that's, you know, forever associated with Christmas, in which Rupert Murdoch jumped off a bridge, and we then showed him how the world would have been had he never lived.
I keep telling you, you haven't been born yet.
On there you go, kids.
People don't have satellite TV. They don't have the chance to watch World Wrestling and Wheel of Fortune video bloopers 24 hours a day. They're still forced to watch the old BBC and ITV with all that drama and sports and news programs. You did away with all that.
I did?
Mm-hmm. Swept it all away. You pretended it was to give people more choice, but actually it was just to be fabulously rich.
And obviously in the Jimmy Stewart version, the world is a poorer place for Jimmy Stewart not having been there. But with this version, clearly the world is a much nicer place for Murdoch not having been there.
You like it? You really like it? It's fantastic. It's paradise. Oh, help me, Clarence. I want to live again. Well, this is marvelous, Rupert. Just think of the money I can make in a world like this.
All impersonations need the permission of the people being impersonated, and producers must reassure that this has been given before allowing any to be broadcast.
Can you imagine Hugh Laurie asking Rupert Murdoch for permission? Although these days, with Hugh's success in the US, it might be tricky to say who the most powerful man is. Another comedy outfit famed for their pastiches were Dawn French and Jennifer Saunders, who were part of the new generation of Red Brick University comics who had come through the alternative comedy circuit. No mean feat to become TV staples in what could be a male-dominated bear pit to John Plowman.
Quite a few male comedians spend a lot of time beating their head against a wall, saying, I know somehow if we can get the words in the right order and throw a few typewriters out the window, we'll get to the perfect sketch. Dawn and Jennifer have a better attitude, which says, look, this is what we do, and if you find it funny, hooray, and if you don't, well, don't watch, that's okay. And I think that's what allows them to be silly, because being silly is quite a tricky thing to do on television. If I have a memory of them at Christmas, it's as the two very fat men watching the Queen's Christmas speech, and, if I can say this decorously, lusting after Her Majesty, in a physical way, up against the television.
She's handsome woman, isn't she? Handsome.
She's a good-looking woman, that one.
Yeah. She's smart. She's always smart.
Yeah. I'll be proud to have her on my arm.
Yeah, yeah. God. Not like a sister, eh?
God, what a sister.
She's a bit crazy. Hey.
She's a bat shit,
that one. Oh, yeah. She's girl's like a bunny, eh?
Not like a magistrate.
No.
Not like a magistrate.
She's a fine woman.
Smolder. Yeah.
Smouldering,
she's bubbling, isn't she?
Aye,
bubbling aye. In her passion, isn't she?
While it was true that new comedy was having a profound effect on comedy in the 80s, and that sitcoms with a traditional feel like Terry and June were waning, there was, after a hiatus, still room for shows that were more conventional, at least at first sight.
They say I might as well face the truth, but I am just too long in the tooth.
One Foot in the Grave was just such a show. It featured Richard Wilson as grumpy old man Victor Meldrew, who bridged the gap between Tony Hancock and the more anarchic energy of a younger generation of comedian. Mildrew was, therefore, the perfect Christmas antidote and comic foil to all that unnecessary cheer.
So, anyhow, Jean, how's it all shaping up? Have you found anyone yet to play that other part in your nativity production?
Not yet, no.
Look at this. The ideal Christmas gift. This superb reproduction 200 years old antique commode. What are they used for toilet paper, the Dead Sea Scrolls?
As a matter of fact, we were wondering if you'd be interested, Mr. Meldrew.
Interested in what?
In playing one of the parts for us in this year's nativity.
Oh, depends what the part is.
It's the back half of a cow.
Oh, so it's not just any old part.
Oh, no, not at all. As I say, Mr. Gosling from the chip shop was originally down for it. Then he backed out because he was afraid of looking stupid. And that's when we thought of you.
Somewhat more charitable was Dawn French in The Vicar of Dibley.
Reference to and jokes about religions or religious denominations are banned.
The Holy Trinity may have been taboo in the late 1940s, but the reality was that to talk about Christmas without talking about religion would indeed be miraculous. While Jennifer Saunders was going great guns in her sitcom Absolutely Fabulous, Dawn made Richard Curtis's warm, witty comedy about a female country vicar her own.
Now then, just before we start eating, I'd like to tell you a little story. It's about the lovely, kind woman who's a vicar.
Oh, just like you?
Yes, and because she was trying to be kind to her parishioners, she agreed to have three different sets of Christmas lunch.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Isn't it? Yes. I mean, the first lunch, well, she was okay. By the second lunch, I mean, she was trying to manage to get it down. But by the time she got to the third family, you know, she was absolutely stuffed.
Was she?
Yes, she was.
Was she?
Yes, she was.
Yes, she was.
She couldn't eat another bite.
I bet the thought of one more slice of turkey made her absolutely sick.
I bet it made her absolutely sick.
Did it? I bet it did.
It did it?
Yes, it certainly did. But since the third family was where her absolute best friend lived...
Oh, like, I'm your best friend?
Yeah, she decided to tell her best friend all about the three meals problem.
Oh, good idea.
Yes, because she knew her best friend would take pity on her and say, hey, you don't have to eat all that food if you don't want to. Just have a cup of tea instead, you know, to help her out.
Oh, that's where it's not like me at all.
On the one hand, there are those who point out that Christmas has been divorced from religion. And so, talking about the two together seems fair. But on the other hand, religious sensibilities have to be considered. It is a tricky balance to strike if you want to capture the spirit of a key religious festival, which Dibley did in a disarming way, whilst Till Death Do Us Part put it all out in the open. A trait shared by Jim Royle in the Royal Family.
I would like to leave this city. This old town don't smell too pretty.
Caroline Ahern and Craig Cash's sitcom about the Northern Extended Family Unit started in 1998 and has continued to live on in the form of Christmas specials. Episodes of the sitcom have actually been used in religious study lessons to demonstrate the role of the family, though not every moment of the royal household was what you could call virtuous.
No, Justin. Dave said you were in hospital a few months ago.
Yes, I've had an unruly bowel, Barbara.
Oh, Jocelyn, an unruly bowel?
Yes, It was out of control all summer. But you know, the people at EasyJet, they were so understanding.
Oh. My mum was a martyr to her bowels, wasn't she, Jim? But she was the other way. Impacted.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
In the end, they gave her a barium and pneuma.
Mm.
You know, they found things that were lodged up there since the early 60s.
It wasn't just the home hearth that conjures up embarrassment or misty-eyed moments of seasonal cheer, though, as The Office proved. Ricky Gervais and Stephen Merchant's mockumentary sitcom, set in the slough offices of a paper merchant, now remade to great acclaim in the US, could arguably be considered as half an hour of comedy drama. So able was it to provoke an emotional response beyond a simple tug on the funny bone.
I remember reading the script of The Office, and it's set up that there's going to be a Christmas party, and that David Brent has been fired, if I remember correctly, but has announced that he will be there with a woman. And we know that, you know, he's not God's gift to women, and therefore it's slightly unlikely. So clearly he's going to be lying, isn't he? And they did a rather wonderful thing, which is he arrives with a woman who is clearly the right woman for him.
We've brought you the long way round. This is Chris, Neil, Carol.
Hi, Carol.
Hi. This evening. So, Yeah. Let's get you some alcohol, shall we? What's your fancy? We've got wine, we've got beer.
Oh, no. Watching the
video. Oh, let me do that.
Vodka?
Yeah, vodka's fine.
Pint of vodka.
Pint.
Joking.
Oh. Try to send me an alky then.
And Dawn and Martin Freeman's character finally, after two series of us thinking, they should be together, why aren't they together, why is she going off with that terrible man? And in the last episode at the Christmas party, appears to be sort of going off forever with this terrible man. Finally, all our hopes are resolved. And in a way, that's sort of the essence of Christmas.
Chestnuts roasting on an open fire.
The essence of Christmas is not just eggnog. It's what every comedy writer, performer and producer wants to bottle and then flavour their special with each time. And the allure of trying to find this recipe is truly seductive. As we approach the closing minutes of our show, the importance of a happy ending to wrap everything up weighs heavily on our shoulders. a feeling experienced by generations of programme makers.
The last Steptoe we did was a Christmas special, and it was the only show in which the young man triumphed in the end. Throughout the 14 years previously, everything had been a total disaster. The subject matter was him and the father going away for the skiing season.
Christmas in the snow. Are those little ski villages nestling against the mountain side? The clean air, the blue skies, the sun.
The broken legs.
The broken...
They finally get to Waterloo Station, and Harold's passport is out of date.
Your passport, please.
Come on, Harold!
His passport, sir. It's a year out of date.
No, can't be.
Date of expiry, October the 23rd, 1973.
So? No! Come on, Harold!
My passport's out of date!
You dozy great pillock! Danny McQueen.
And the old man gets on the train. And quite callously, he just leaves him there. He doesn't care about, you know, he's going to enjoy himself.
You better get a move on, sir. You'll miss the train.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'll see you after Christmas, Harold.
I shouldn't go if I were you, sir.
You can't go without me,
sir.
You see the train going out of Waterloo Station, and then we see Harold looking, you know, gradually he starts smiling, and he skips out of Waterloo Station, outside the station, in a little open sports car. It's this ravishing blonde. And he's off for the weekend in Bognor with the bird, which is what he's been angling for all along.
He's gone! We were alone, I lost!
So it's the only time he won. And the episode, because that was the last Steptoe as well. All wasn't lost, he triumphed eventually.
To make it complete, there's you, the mistletoe. And me.
The cliches are that family will get together, family will have row, something will go wrong with the cooking of the Christmas. You know, there's a limit to what you can do with Christmas. You can play those things with your set of characters. But some programmes are more satisfying if you sort of ignore it. Or not ignore it, but know that it's there, but don't play those tropes. You know, so Extras, for example, finishes warmly, and in a way, maybe warmth is the secret of what you want for Christmas.
Do you know what a friend of mine once said? They said, I'll never be happy because I'll never be famous enough. And they were right. And if you're watching this, I'm so sorry. You're my best friend. You're my only friend. And you never did anything wrong. It was everything else. I'll never do that again. I'll never treat you like that again. You asked me a stupid question once, and I said, I've answered it, and I didn't, because I'll answer it now. I'd be the penguin, because I could eat the flying fish. I know what you're thinking, wasn't the fish fly away? Well, they can't really fly, they sort of glide and flap. They should be called glidey flappy fish. I'm so sorry.
Are you waiting to hear that, mate?
I don't think
he's a good guy. He's a good guy.
Yeah.
Extras ends with Ricky sort of becoming a star, but also realising that he's been treating Ashley fantastically badly as he's got more and more famous. And just suddenly realising that he's been an idiot. And coming to terms with not being an idiot.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
And of course, I'll certainly never forget the ending to the 1996 Christmas specials, where Del Boy finally became a millionaire.
What was the final outcome?
It was bought by an anonymous bidder. He's giving it to the Maritime Museum at Greenwich, so at least it stays in the country.
Oh, yeah, well, that's nice, isn't it? Oh, you wally. That was the final score. What exactly did it go for?
Oh, $6.2 million. So that's just over 3 million each.
Well, we've had worse days.
You want to go first, or should I?
Well, yeah, why don't we go together?
Yeah, yeah, all right. One, two, three.
So, what have we learned? What is the secret of Christmas comedy? Something that has mass appeal? Something that gets through to the befuddled head and full of stomach? That cuts through family rows, commercialism, religious sensitivity, with goodwill, generosity, and delivers a hopeful message and a line more memorable than you'd find in a Christmas cracker? Ultimately, it's a feast as filling as a Christmas pud and more memorable than the biggest bird. Something that is funny with a capital F and fills an hour with sunshine from start to finish. Easy peasy. Let's leave the last word to those who broke our last rule from the Green Book on Light Entertainment and were undoubtedly the kings of Christmas comedy.
Producers must, however, take all possible steps to ensure that defamatory material is not included in scripts. Most likely forms for it to take are A, an uncomplimentary gag by one artist about a fellow artist or other person.
I wonder what it is.
Well, it's a long player, isn't it?
Huh?
It's a long player.
Oh, really? Mm. Lovely. Marvellous, that. Yeah. I don't look really happy. Yeah.
Is it something I've always wanted, like something you've always wanted?
An old Bing Crosby or something like that?
Not Bing Crosby.
No, no. Louis Armstrong?
No, it's not Louis Armstrong.
Ellie Wallace?
No.
Oh.
Des O'Connor. All I said was Des O'Connor.
My hand, my hand. Oh, God, if you want me to be a goner, get me an LP by Des O'Connor. Look at that face!
That's the most unusual record he's ever made.
This is one where he sings the right notes.
David Jason's comedy Christmas classics was written by Julian Hall and produced by Sam Gregory, Mark Pittam, and Phil Critchlow at TBI Media.
This is BBC Radio 2, online on